The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those familiar words from Gramsci, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast. My name is Jeet here, and the podcast is sponsored by The Nation. This week, we're going to be looking at arguably two of the greatest monsters in American history, Roy Cohn and Donald Trump, who are the main figures in a new movie that has just come out called The Apprentice. And to talk about this movie, I'm very happy to have on frequent guest of the program, David Kleon, who reviewed the movie for The Nation. And we'll link to the review in the show notes. But first of all, welcome, David. And can you just tell listeners what the movie's about?
Oh, great to be here as always. So this movie is basically a, I guess you could call it a biopic, but it's focused not just on young Donald.
Actually, I think the best description I've heard is it's a supervillain origin story.
It's a supervillain origin story. I like that. It is the story of a younger Donald Trump and how he was shaped by his relationship with Roy Cohn. And Trump is played by Sebastian Stan of Captain America, Bucky fame. And Cohn is played by Jeremy Strong of Succession fame, Kendall Roy. And honestly, those two performances alone would be ample justification to see this movie. They both hit it out of the park. They both really capture these two guys and what they were about. And I think with Trump in particular, and I talk about this in my review, Trump is an overly familiar figure these days, to say the least. But the Trump that we're familiar with is the Trump of the last decade or so, or even the last two decades, who, you know, has been imitated on SNL and so on. And you know, who's very kind of rambling and digressive and conspiratorial. And, you know, there's a whole shtick around him. And some of the popular impressions of him are more, you know, spot on than others. But I think what gets lost, because people weren't paying as close attention to him before in most cases, is that Trump wasn't always like he is now. That's not to say he wasn't always a monster or a sexist or racist or take your pick, but he was a younger man once, and he was much more lucid and much more, I would say, in touch with reality. Albeit maybe a narrow slice of reality. And if you go back and watch old interviews with him, which you can find just on YouTube or whatever, going back to circa 1980, when he's in his early 30s, it's really, really striking how different he was back then. And this movie, which takes place between the early to mid 70s and the mid to late 80s, really captures that Trump, this Trump who is a figure of New York and who's a figure on the make, and shows how Roy Cohn played this crucial role in making him who he is. And in my review, I mean, I generally enjoyed the movie. I know you didn't as much, and we can talk about that a little. But in the review, I basically make the case that, though I don't think it's a perfect movie by any means, it's a movie that's very worth seeing. With a lot to recommend it and a lot of relevance to now, and it is bombing catastrophically. It is a total flop, even though critics generally like it.
Yeah, no. We'll get to like maybe why it's a flop, but I will say, although I have some questions about the movie, I would actually recommend it as a, very much a movie worth watching. As you mentioned, the two performances are very strong, and particularly with Sebastian Stan as Trump. I mean, the interesting thing is it's Trump before he's Trump. So this is a young Trump who's very uncertain, who's even like a little bit shy and like doesn't know how to present himself into the world. And, you know, it's coming out of a like a very bad family dynamic where his father is a very sort of discouraging father. And he finds in Roy Cohn a kind of mentor who can teach him the ropes. And it is very convincing as that sort of supervillain origin story of like, how did Trump actually learn to be Trump? As such, I think it's very interesting. And I mean, you mentioned like, it gives us a Trump that we're not used to seeing, And I think it also gives us a Roy Cohn that perhaps most people aren't familiar with, which is to say that the Roy Cohn of historical memory, to the extent that people are familiar with him, it's the very young Roy Cohn. He was like in his early 20s when he was an assistant to Joseph McCarthy and a lawyer working on the Rosenberg case, maybe mid-20s. That Roy Cohn, monstrous villain, lived on for decades afterwards and became, and I think this is what, I think you have to be maybe know a lot about the history of New York to understand this, but he became a figure in the world of New York. And he was technically a lawyer, but he's really a power broker, somebody who knew all the ins and outs and who could fix things and could solve problems and who operated in the realm not so much of money, but of favors, of quid pro quo, and what you could do, and also operated in the realm of sort of like information edging in towards blackmail. And that's also very important for understanding who Trump is and the world that he comes from. I think the movie should say that
there's a late in life portrayal of Roy Cohn that a lot of people are very familiar with, which is Tony Kushner's Angels in America, which I've never seen on stage, but I've seen the HBO Al Pacino portrayal of him, which is very good. And that's the Roy Cohn who's dying of AIDS, except he insists it's liver cancer, but everyone knows it's AIDS.
And that's the Cohn. We're with the very young Cohn and the very old Cohn, who's also in this movie.
Yeah.
But that sort of middle-aged Cohn at the sort of really the height of his power, is not a Cohn that people are familiar with, but is actually like a very important political figure. And one should say, like, even though he's like, was a right winger, never stopped defending Joseph McCarthy, was totally plugged into what one consider the world of like liberal New York. He had a lot of friends in the sort of media world, almost got into like a fake marriage with Barbara Walters, as a kind of, I guess you could say closeted gay man, although I don't think that's quite accurate.
It was a glass closet.
Yeah.
Everyone knew that he was
gay, but also that he would not think of himself as gay. I mean, like, I think to understand Roy Cohn, you have to understand that he thought that gay men were men who were effeminate, weak, and he was the, he was the dominant figure in all his relationships.
Which is funny although you wouldn't say he was weak, or he certainly had a range of cultivated tastes that, aren't unstereotypically gay, but he was also very kind of like mobster-like and worked with actual mobsters and
very mobbed up, which is also part of, his sort of power. I mean, there's reasons why, like, a lot of figures, that one would consider part of the liberal establishment would occasionally go to Roy Cohn for favors, and why Donald Trump hooked up with him. I will say this not in a kind of any sort of partisan way, but I mean, I think one thing to understand about Roy Cohn was he was a lifelong registered Democrat. And very plugged into the Democratic political machine of New York, which is not at all.
Despite his personal friendships with Richard Nixon and Joe McCarthy and so
that's
on.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. But which is not to say he was a liberal, because as we know that political establishment is not liberal. But in any case, so for the young Trump, it is the sort of, the meeting of the devil with his young apprentice. And I think for me, that's the most effective part of the movie and the part that's very convincing and tells a story that's very important.
Yeah.
I do kind of feel like the movie loses its edge when it tries to do a little too much and covers other aspects of his life, including his first marriage, and tries to maybe explain Trump a little bit too much. And you have a lot of like sort of on the nose scenes where like he first encounters the slogan, "Make America Great Again." Which I feel like all detract from this central story, this central relationship. And the reason I like the Cohn stuff so much is like it actually does explain like, the political world and the type of politics that Trump practices, which is sort of transcends kind of like left-right. It's really the politics of these kind of elite insiders who traffic in gossip and through a personal destruction. Interestingly enough, I mean, I think the movie, once you understand that Roy Cohn was so important to Trump, you see Trump's larger connection to American history, that there is a kind of apostolic succession of American demagoguery that goes from like Joseph McCarthy to Roy Cohn to Donald Trump to, I guess, J.D. Vance, right?
Like, or in the other direction, you could go back to like Father Coughlin or...
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. All the people that McCarthy himself who were the real like fascists. So, I mean, there are people, like friend of the show, Danny Bessner, who like are very insistent that, what do you mean when you say Trump is a fascist, and where is this indigenous American far right tradition that he's part of? Well, like, no, if Donald Trump's major political mentor, what is in his the formative age in his 20s was Roy Cohn, then that is a direct link to the American far right.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to say before we get into the Ivana stuff and the maybe some of the weaknesses of the second half of the movie, there are a few other things besides the excellent casting and the just rich subject matter of that central relationship that really worked for me. One is, there are a lot of movies about politics, a lot that I've reviewed for our friends at TNR, that, you get the sense the filmmaker read an article that inspired them to write a script. But they're not as steeped in this as they could be, or they get certain things wrong. I'm sure this movie got some things wrong. I'm not expert enough to say what they are, but the script was written by Gabriel Sherman, who is a real reporter who's deeply plugged into the New York power elite and its history. Is adapting the script from his real reporting. So while I think there were things that were dramatized or speculative or could probably be contested, overall, there's a real sense, I think, of authenticity to this script and to the details in it that really worked for me. And it seemed, I could tell that like, there are books that he has read, like, with all the stuff about how Trump gets his tax breaks to develop Trump Tower in the middle of the city's austerity. I was like, Gabriel Sherman has probably read Kim Phillips Fine's Fear City, or at least read articles that summarize that book and its story of austerity. Everything about this movie, and especially in the first half, like struck me as someone who just reads about the history of New York City and major players in New York City as just really well grounded in that, even beyond the specific biographies of Donald Trump or Roy Cohn. And then the filmmaking too is very, I think, reflective of some of the cinematic history of New York. I mean, the first half of the movie, which is the 70s, any American casual cinephile knows the era of Taxi Driver, Taking of Pelham 1-2-3 or French Connection or Panic in Needle Park or whatever, that whole kind of gritty 70s look. And the first half of the movie really recaptures that, really recaptures the vibe of New York, and not just of like seedy Manhattan drug dealers and sex workers and so on, Times Square marquees, but also you get a look at the outer boroughs, you get a look at the kind of, I've actually walked around Jamaica Estates and seen Trump's two childhood homes there in Queens, which are, a certain era's idea of gaudy McMansion, though they look almost modest by what you might expect today. But the movie, I don't know if it was filmed on that exact location, but it persuasively evokes it anyway. You see him in the buildings that his father owns doing door-to-door rent collection. And it's all just like a thing I thought about, like, it sounds silly to say, that America doesn't really know New York or whatever. I mean, New York is wildly overrepresented in our cultural landscape. But there is a sense, I feel, in which the New York that Americans know or think they know is often very midtown focused, very power elite focused. The New York that we see at the end of the movie when Trump is talking to his ghostwriter for The Art of the Deal. And you know, the movie kind of ends with, this is how Trump marketed himself to middle America and sort of created the brand that will eventually develop into The Apprentice, the show, and then into his political career. You know, that America, even in the mid 80s, I think feels, you know, like there's a direct and obvious line to like what an American might imagine Manhattan is like today. Mm-hmm. But there's something about this 70s New York in all its, you know, from the periphery to the center, like glory, that's familiar to like people of a certain generation or to people who follow certain cultural trends, but that I feel is actually not as, it's not normally what we think about when we think about like the current American political landscape, you know, like it's not like, if we think about America today, we think about like rich blue cities like New York or San mm-hmm. Francisco or, you know, Boston or wherever. And then we think about like the heartland and the Bible Belt and, mm-hmm. and the Rust Belt and all this stuff. But like that New York, the New York that actually produced Donald Trump, I feel is a kind of like fading part of the American imagined cultural landscape. And to see it persuasively recreated in this context, I thought actually like make some sense of Trump as a historical figure and not as just like a cartoon character or a set of like predictable political tropes. So I really appreciated that about this movie.
Yeah, no, I do think that the movie is very rooted in and very sort of specific. And in terms of like that sort of New York, I mean, I think people's sense of that sort of Manhattan world is might be, as you sort of suggested, a little bit too partisan and too kind of like, you know, like the liberal New York of Woody Allen's Manhattan or whatever.
Not to mention that Donald Trump built the Manhattan that people imagine now, right? Yeah, and the movie yeah. is and the movie is also very fair, because this is a movie that like first of all sets it up so that the audience could plausibly sympathize with Donald Trump for at least in the first half. Because they see how abusive and awful his father is.
Yeah, he is the Donald Trump of the beginning. He's an underdog.
Because he's this outer borough guy trying to make it, because he has to learn some things, which Roy Cohn can show him. I mean, he's an anti-hero the way, you know, Walter White or someone is an anti-hero. But you can, in like dramatic terms, you can root for him as the protagonist, at least to a point. And because he has this one big thing relevant to what I was just saying, which is, he understands in 1973, 4 or 5, when Manhattan is just a disaster zone, when, you know, austerity has hit it and everyone is giving up on it. And his father has, you know, is basically a suburbanite for all intents and purposes in Queens, building this outer borough, you know, middle-class housing empire or slumlord housing empire. He understands that the future of Midtown Manhattan is glamour and wealth and power and prestige. And that seems super obvious in retrospect, but like the movie does a very good job of showing that that was actually a bold insight at the time, even if the way they have to do it is by breaking a bunch of laws and ripping off the public and ripping off workers and so on and blackmailing people. You know, the core insight is a good one and one that a lot of people doubted, and you can root for that. This is also a movie that shows him raping his wife. So yeah, it's very clear where the movie comes down on what kind of person Donald Trump is.
That young Trump, it is kind of set up as a kind of classic underdog hero who's underestimated, who finds the mentor who can help him, and who does have that vision, that dream, which everyone mocks, but which, you know, turns out to be true.
And in a way, I totally bought also. Yeah, like, I haven't seen the new Reagan movie that I heard the Chapo Trap House review of it, where they were just going to town on it. But, like, look, I would love to see a good dramatization of Reagan's life, but it sounds like that's just a very shoddily made, you know, like, by-the-numbers right-wing hagiography. This is not. This movie is, first of all, crystal clear about the moral and, you know, political and social impact of everything Trump and Cohn has done, and is made with actual artistry, but it earns, like, it made as a movie where the filmmakers clearly don't like Trump, and I don't like Trump either, and Trump doesn't like this movie, and his people have been attacking it. I still think they did a very good job of selling it as like, oh, this guy did have something. Like,
yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, no, I mean, I thought that, and I would say for the first half of the movie, he's not a caricature. He's an actual, like, plausible human being. You can imagine him and going there. That this is who he was, and these are the, you know, choices that he made, and he has these sort of mixed qualities of good and bad. In terms of the New Yorkness, I do want to emphasize the New York power broker element, which I think is sort of so key. And, you know, you mentioned, you know, that Gabriel Sherman knows the history. I'd be very surprised if he hasn't read Nicholas von Hoffman's biography of Roy Cohn. And in that book, you know, one of the things he documents is just how much Cohen's actual trade was not so much law, but sort of blackmail and information and bribery, and how, you know, it's pretty clear that Cohen had more than a few New York judges in his pockets, and that, you know, you wanted him as a lawyer not because he knew the law, you know, like, you know, he would barely read any of the documents in the case, but because he knew, you know, don't tell me the law, tell me the judge. Right. And the movie like brings that out, and I think that can be connected very clearly to a lot of Trump's later actions, and particularly his relationship with the National Enquirer and, you know, that sort of world. I mean, it's very effective. I mean, I don't want to spend too much time in our disagreement with the movie. I'll just say that I do feel like at the sort of halfway point, it expands and becomes more broadly about Trump, and he becomes more the Trump we know, which is already a sort of caricature of himself and is therefore much less interesting as a cinematic character than the kind of, you know, young formative Trump. And then I feel like the movie, in the last half kind of loses itself. Whereas I feel like if a better edited, sharply focused movie on just the Trump-Cohen relationship, it would have been a great movie with these actors and with this script. And I think the trajectory of that relationship, not to say that one can ever be sympathetic with, you know, Roy Cohn, but there is this element of genuine pathos of, you know, Cohn's kind of descent into AIDS, his denial, and the way that, you know, Trump starts to keep him at a particular distance and becomes the classic, you know, student that doesn't need the master anymore.
Yeah.
The Cohen story like is like super fascinating, super revealing, and would have been enough. And like my film criticism critique of the movie is it just tries to do too much. And
I guess I agree that the first half of the movie is better, but I sort of wonder, given the just real story they're working with, like, do you think it should have just ended earlier? Or do you think that they should have just like downplayed all the Ivana stuff? And like, what would you have? Because Trump does become that person, right?
Like, Trump does become that person, but I don't think you need to like go into like great details. I think he's already become that. We've already seen him become that person through the narrative of his relationship with Cohen. And then you could show him becoming that person in dramatic terms by his disavow of Cohen and his kind of, you know.
Right. The movie kind of gives us three or four or five distinct bad things that are going on with Trump in that second half. One is that he's repulsed by Cohn, who's done all this stuff for him. He's disgusted by him having AIDS. He's like spraying down everything and doesn't want to touch him. And one is that having courted Ivana, this, you know, Czech model that he sees at the club, having courted her very aggressively, but in a way charmingly in the first half, he starts to reject her. There's a very disturbing and historically plausible scene in which he rapes her on camera. He also starts, you know, sleeping with sex workers and just kind of, you know, dismisses her. And then there's also this plot line about his brother, which I had maybe vaguely heard of before, but never paid attention to. But he had this older brother, Fred Jr., who was, not the favored son. For all that Fred Trump was terrible to Donald, he was much worse to his older son, who, you know, did not follow him into the family business, became a commercial airline pilot, was a huge disappointment, and was an alcoholic. Whereas Donald, the once and perhaps future president, is a teetotaler. And the brother, you know, destroys himself with alcohol. But in the first half of the movie, you see Donald seeming to love his brother and to want to have a relationship with him, maybe because they feel solidarity vis-a-vis their dad. Whereas in the second half, you see him, you know, dismissing and rejecting him. Mm-hmm. And there's also that scene after he dies where Donald is in bed with Ivana and you see that she's trying to comfort him in his grief. And he's completely incapable of having that very human and vulnerable emotion, which I thought was a kind of powerful thing to film. And then there's, you know, he also develops an amphetamine habit. He starts modifying his body in various ways. I mean, and he starts, you know, having had this vision for Manhattan, he has a disastrously ill-conceived vision for Atlantic City that Roy Cohn rejects and is right to reject. So yeah, I mean, the whole second half of the movie is just this sort of cascading set of tragedies, self-destructive impulses, ruined relationships that all kind of add up to, oh, that's the jerk that we all know and hate.
Yeah. Yeah. But I just felt like it was like too much. And it's also too much something we already know, which is, you know, who Trump is. Whereas actually, I think the story of how Trump, you know, went from being just a regular entitled jerk to who he is a more interesting story. Because, I mean, I don't think you needed all that. I mean, you know, we already have enough on Trump. And just in terms of as a narrative, like a focus narrative where you just, you would just really need only like one scene with the brother or one scene with the Ivana to just convey all that. You didn't need to go into, it became a bit plodding and a bit like wanting to underscore everything that was like, you know, is wrong with Trump, which I don't think is necessary. But actually, I think that actually brings up the other issue, which is why this movie, which, you know, you liked, and I liked a little bit less, but I think is actually a good and worthwhile movie, is, you know, like not doing very well. And I think it's also, there's a real Trump fatigue that's out there. And this election, this is like, you know, the sort of third American election I've covered, very closely, or maybe the fourth, going back to 2012. But like, I just can't help but notice that people aren't super engaged in the election, like to the extent that if they have very strong partisan feelings, they are like maybe following the polls or going out and volunteering, but they don't really want to read about, like, they already know who Trump is and he's already defined. And you see that in the polling, like opinion about Trump does not shift. Like there's a segment of the public, you know, I'd say like, you know, 40% plus another 6% that are just partisan Republicans, you know, who are okay with him. And then, you know, like, 50, 52, 53% that don't like him in varying degrees. That hasn't really changed. I don't think it's actually changed since 2016. And so at some point, people just think like, well, you know, I know who Trump is. I don't like this guy or I like this guy. And in either case, I don't need to know anything more about him, right? Right. And you see it in the same way, like, you know, the whole question of why people aren't going to Trump's rallies in the same way or walking out. It's like we've seen this act so much. And I feel that, unfortunately, I think, you know, despite this being a worthwhile movie, that cuts against it, this Trump fatigue.
Yeah, so I totally agree with your assessment of where the American public is at right now, general fatigue, generally. I mean, the polls seem to be a dead heat, you know, 2 weeks out. And everyone I know is very scared. It feels like a complete coin toss whether we're going to have a very terrifying future or something like the status quo, for better or worse. Mm-hmm. Everyone I know simultaneously really hopes it's the latter. And also, you know, often, I mean, in my circles, a lot of people care about Gaza and Israel-Palestine a lot. And from that point of view, there's been a huge amount of disappointment with the direction that Kamala Harris has taken. At the same time, everyone understands that Trump would be even worse. So it's just, you know, the vibes are not great at the moment. I think they would be even worse if Biden, in his advanced senility were still the nominee, but
it,
I think he would be clearly losing for one thing, but the vibes are still not great. And, you know, we don't have to belabor the election, but I think what is important for these purposes is that, you know, no one wants to see this. I mean, it's had distributional challenges also because the Trump people have gone after it. There have been legal threats, which is odd because not only does the movie factually not, you know, I mean, the rape of Ivana, which is the most controversial scene, is something that, you know, she was in her divorce papers years ago, and then
she signed an affidavit to that effect.
Yeah, and then even she disavowed after, it
she
later.
Disavowed it, but she did not disavow it like under oath. So
no, and I think you can reason, but like there's no like new breaking unknown information in this movie, even if it might be unfamiliar to some viewers. And you could argue that. I mean, I wouldn't argue this, certainly not as a knock on the movie, but as I was saying earlier, you know, in some ways it casts him in a positive light. I mean, I think his fans are less likely to be disturbed by the fact that he commits an act of sexual assault on camera than his critics are to be grudgingly impressed by some of his, you know, foresight early on. And that's, you know, not because the movie is Trumpist propaganda. It's just because I think it's a thoughtfully made movie. But I don't think this movie would change anyone's mind about whether to vote for Donald Trump or not, which, to be honest, if that were the point of it, it wouldn't be art. It would be agitprop. And I actually do think this movie is art, maybe not great art, but art.
No, I agree with that. Yeah.
And so I think in that context, like, it really is that people just don't want to see it. And I think I said this in my review, but the famous writer and director Paul Schrader, who, you know, actually wrote the script for Taxi Driver, he obvious influence on this. He's on Letterboxd, the movie reviewing site, and he did a review for this movie, and he called it excellent. He said it's an excellent film, but he also said he walked out about three quarters of the way through because, I'm loosely paraphrasing here, but basically it's a movie that forces you to spend 2 hours or so in the company of a repulsive, you know, monstrous man. Now, by coincidence, actually, this past week, some friends and I watched a movie that Schrader directed, Mishima, about the Japanese fascist writer. And I was thinking, this guy made a movie about a Japanese fascist. Which is an incredible movie, by the way. And it's too much for him to spend two hours in the presence of Donald Trump.
I will, you know, say what you want about the tenets of the Japanese imperial state, but Mishima was a very talented writer.
For sure.
And,
And, for sure, but still, he's not a great guy.
Much more at ease with his homosexuality than Roy Cohn.
that last one is highly debatable. But I'm not sure I'm qualified to debate it.
The cultural context is probably too different.
The cultural context is different, but the main point is if Paul Schrader, you know, an artist and a guy who's dwelt, you know, Taxi Driver is a movie about.
Yeah, no, all Schrader's movies are about very troubled men.
Right.
And who are, you know, Taxi Driver, Schrader has himself said, is a sort of prophecy of incels. So, right.
And that guy doesn't want to sit through. And I don't even mean this as a criticism of him, just as like, that is so emblematic of how much Trump fatigue there is right now.
Because
what this movie does that we've been discussing, that, like, I don't think this movie is here to change anyone's mind about whether or not to vote for Donald Trump. I think what this movie could do for people, regardless of how they currently feel about Trump, is, and that I think is uncomfortable for some very smart, very educated, very liberal people, is there is this sense of unreality about Donald Trump, right? Mm-hmm. He's become such a caricature, such a, like, a self-parody, such a creature of TV and is like ever recurring bits. And the fascination, but also fatigue with him comes from not on some level wanting to accept that this really is a major political figure in American history and the American present, and that it is who we are, and that, like, you know, not only are we a country where, let's say, half the people would vote for this guy, we're also a country whose like foreign policy gets shaped by this guy, whose immigration policies get shaped by this guy, whose economic policies get shaped by this guy. And there's this level of, I think, just distaste from savvier, more sophisticated, more intellectual, or more kind of classically liberally patriotic people.
Yeah.
The kind of people who read The Atlantic, let's say, this sense, you know, and who are like disturbed by, you know, what Trump's generals are telling Jeffrey Goldberg this week, or what David Frum or Anne Applebaum have to say about Trump and authoritarianism. There's this sense of just perpetual distaste. Like, really, this guy? We really have to think about this guy? I reviewed David Frum's, your fellow Canadian David Frum's book, Trumpocalypse, a few years ago. And there was a line in it that kind of resonated with me, but that actually feels apropos in hindsight right now, where he's like, you know, again, loosely paraphrasing, but he's like, I've just spent more time than I ever wanted to thinking about this terrible man or something. And I think he speaks for a lot of people in that sense. But my rebuke to that at this point, you know, 8 years and or 9 years and counting into the Trump political era, is like, sorry, we have to think about him. He's too important. And this movie takes him seriously.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. I'd agree with that. I would actually say, I mean, like, unfortunately, like, whoever wins the election, Trump has really, you know, reshaped American politics so that the Democratic Party now has adopted many of his policies in terms of immigration, in terms of trade, and in terms
of Israel-Palestine.
In terms of foreign policy. No, absolutely. I will also say, I mean, so if you want to define Trump fatigue, it's not so much people don't want to be thinking about Trump. I mean, I think if Saturday Night Live did another skit, I think it might, you know, with Alec Baldwin or whatever, it would still get traction.
The guy who replaced him, James Austin Johnson, is better than Alec Baldwin. Yeah. Just at the level of impression.
Or if there's like another, you know, book from Bob Woodward, book I think is still doing well and is sort of, you know, has sort of juicy anti-Trump gossip, which people always love. But I mean, what people are fatigued by, or not even fatigued by, but never want to engage with, is any sort of thoughtful reflection on who Trump is and where he comes from in American history.
Yeah.
I mean, there are a few exceptions. I think our mutual friend John Gans, with his book When the Clock Broke,
which pairs very well with this movie, I would say.
But I mean, in general, among the sort of liberal educated class, any sort of engagement with Trump that's like thoughtful, that actually, like, you know, does is beyond the sort of orange man bad, you know, level of analysis, there's no appetite for that, and especially not if it actually implicates the wider American society in Trumpism. But yeah. I think that, you know, like the America where like Roy Cohn, not only as a young man was able to, you know, work with McCarthy and, you know, push the legal system to execute the Rosenbergs and you know, make the American state something that created two orphans.
As he notes in the movie, to execute both Rosenbergs, it was very important to him Rosenbergs. That they get Ethel too.
But he became Roy Cohn. I've mentioned this before. I really want to underscore this. Was a major power player in New York in the 60s and 70s and 80s, and was not only lionized by a lot of conservatives like William F. Buckley, but also like all the sort of centrist liberal media, people like Barbara Walters, people like Andy Warhol, always eager to go to his parties, to, you know, seek him out when they needed favors. You know, like the America where a Roy Cohn could succeed like that is something that people don't want to think about. But that is a real America, and that's the America that created Donald Trump.
Right. Hence my kicker for this piece, which I'm very pleased with, if I may say so. We are not better than this.
I'll actually close with the cartoonist Jules Pfeiffer once did a comic strip in the 80s when Cohn was sort of dying, which was he was addressing his audience and says, you know, Roy Cohn is my cousin. And he talks about his long relationship with Cohn and how the family used to, you know, tell him, don't be doing this lefty cartooning stuff because they'll embarrass Roy. And then a few years later, Jules Pfeiffer did this other cartoon in the 1990s, the Clinton era, where he said, Dick Morris is my cousin. At some point, I wanted to write to Jules Pfeiffer and say, like, you know, I really hope you don't have any more cousins. But I always love that Roy Cohn is my cousin comic strip that Pfeiffer did, because it's an acknowledgement. You know, like, Roy Cohn is us. And now we can say Donald Trump is us. We are not better than this.
No, we are not better than this. And I think my last comment here would be that maybe there's something else that comes to mind, but there are certainly good books that have been written about Donald Trump and the Trump era. But is there a product of, like, a movie, a TV show that is directly about Donald Trump that takes him as seriously and does as good a job at this one to date? I'm sure there will be more to come, but to date, is this the most serious attempt anyone has made to capture Donald Trump in on camera, like dramatized?
I can't think of anything better than this. No, yeah. I'm sure that there will be more, but this movie. I think you know, you make a very good case for the movie. Yeah. I will actually, you know, mention, even with all my criticism of it, I do think this is a movie people should be watching.
Yeah, and I guess when, you know, the election's coming soon, we hope Harris wins. I'm sure everyone listening to this hopes Harris wins. I know people who are holding off on watching the movie until after the election, and with the, like, caveat that Harris must win first so they can, you know, feel safe from this, basically.
Yeah.
I would say by all means wait till the election, though you probably won't catch it in theaters if you do, but that's fine. It's not Avatar or something, but after the election, if he wins or if he loses, almost more if he wins, I think that this is worth grappling with, even if it's very uncomfortable.
Absolutely. I totally agree with that. Yeah. Okay. So once again, thanks to David Kleon. And Ebert and Sisko says, see you in the balcony.
Great talking to you, Jay.
Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Of the work week is spent communicating, so it's important your team does it well. Enter Grammarly. Grammarly's AI helps teams communicate clearly the first time. It shows you how to make words resonate with your audience, helps with brainstorming, and lets you instantly create and revise drafts in just one click. Join over 70,000 teams and 30 million people who use Grammarly to move work forward. Go to grammarly.com/enterprise to learn more. Grammarly. Enterprise Ready AI.